We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome back to this program time after time after time again the great reporter for such outlets as, in these times, the American Prospect, the New Republic, The Intercept, the Fiscal Times, the Pacific Standard. I mean, anything, that The Nation magazine. David Dayen. Hello, David.
Hello. I'm really hopeful at this point, since I've been on enough, that it's now the Majority Report with Sam Seder and David Dayen.
Well, it's pretty darn close. It's pretty darn close. So I don't know.
I want above the line credit is what I'm looking for.
Well, we'll work on that. That's negotiable. I should also say, author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, which is, as far as I know, multiple award-winning. Is that right?
Maybe single.
All right, fair enough.
I actually have my first royalty check coming in the mail for this little book.
Well, it's well-deserved. It's a great book, and still gets referenced many times about the foreclosure crisis. And all right, but I want to talk about first, there's two different pieces of yours of the multitudes that you write on any given time that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
One is one that I spoke to you about on Ring of Fire a couple of weeks ago. And I finished with asking, when are the hearings? And at that time you didn't know, but as this plays live on Tuesday, April 18th, you are testifying in front of a committee of the California State House about this very issue, and that is the issue of PBMs. What are PBMs?
Right. So PBMs is an acronym for Pharmacy Benefit Managers. And if you pull out your healthcare card, you might see the name of a PBM on it. They are the people who manage your prescription drug benefit. Insurers essentially contract out to these specialists who work with drug manufacturers, who work with pharmacists, and manage all aspects of the prescription drug benefit that you receive through your health plan. And it started in the late 1960s, and they were just sort of claims administrators. They just pushed paper, you know, made sure everybody got reimbursed, and made sure the benefits went through. Over time,
now, wait,
they,
so before you get on to overtime, let me just say we're talking about places like Express Scripts, right? That's one I think that does.
Express Scripts is the biggest pharmacy benefit manager in the country. The second largest is CVS Caremark, which is a part of the pharmacy chain CVS, and the third is Optum Rx, which is a division of United Health. The insurance company actually bought this PBM. And if you take all three of those, you have about 80% of this market, or 180 million prescription drug benefit plans.
Okay, and back when they got set up, they were the ones who provided or basically channeled the reimbursements. Who are the different players that get reimbursements?
Right. So you have the pharmacy. When they make their prescription, they sell it to you, and then they get reimbursed by the PBM on the cost that they paid, because they don't get all the money from you, right? You pay a copay. So the other half of that comes from the pharmacy benefit managers. They negotiate with the drug companies to set the prices for these particular prescription drugs. Sometimes they get rebates from the drug manufacturer. And all that money in rebates and things eventually goes to the health plan. So they're sort of middlemen operating on behalf of the health plan, negotiating with every other side of the market. And the problem is that you have these multiple sides of the market, but only the PBM truly knows all the pricing information. Only they are distributing the money from the drug company to the health plan and to the pharmacy and eventually to the consumer. And that information advantage is what gives the PBM the ability to extract massive profits from every other side of this market and eventually raise the cost of prescription drugs.
So, okay, so the pharmacy has this bottle of some drug.
Acetaminophen.
And so prescription strength acetaminophen. And I go to buy this because I got a bad headache from my kids. And the pharmacy says, okay, it's you only owe $10 because that's your copay. And
that's
the pharmacy gets a cost. It's actually $100, let's say. I don't know.
Right. Maybe the pharmacy pays a wholesaler for that drug, right? So the pharmacy pays a wholesaler $100, and they only collect $10 at the point of sale. So they're down $90 now. Now, when they go to their computer and say, I just sold this bottle of prescription strength acetaminophen, the pharmacy benefit manager at that point tells them, well, we're going to, because this is this person's plan, we're going to reimburse you X amount of dollars. And they literally don't know until they type it in. I mean, think about running a business where you're selling, milk, and you don't know how much you are going to get reimbursed. You don't know what you're going to get back for that milk that you've already paid for and put on your shelf until the moment that you sell it. That's how it works.
It's
hard to run a business this way.
So wait a second. So depending on what my health insurance is, my copay can be different and the actual cost to the pharmacy can be different.
Absolutely. And not only can it be different at that moment, but later on through the process, pharmacy benefit managers use a thing called direct and indirect remuneration fees, where they can claw back those reimbursements based on a certain number of performance characteristics. So you could sell something for $100, 3 months earlier, and then find out you're only getting $70 back because they clawed it back because of certain performance characteristics, like if the individual was taking his drugs in a timely manner, for example. So not only do you not know what you're going to get back for that drug at the time, but 3 months down the road, you could get money clawed back. It's impossible to be an independent pharmacist with the terrible terms that you're given on these contracts that you have to buy into because there are only three of these companies that control pretty much the entire market. So if you can't hold out as a pharmacist and say, I'm not going to work with you guys, you give me bad contract terms, well, then you're cutting off, a third of your customer base. You can't do that. So
wait a second. So let me ask you this. So how does the pharmacy have any way of mitigating this? I mean, they can't raise prices, right? Because there's no they're completely priced.
They're locked in.
They're locked
in on prices. The decision that's made every day by independent pharmacists all over the country is, do we sell this product at a loss and keep this customer who might buy other things in our store, or do we say to this customer, I can't sell that to you because I'm going to lose too much money if I sell that to you, and watch that customer walk out the door? This is the decision that gets made on a daily basis, multiple times a day, by independent pharmacists. And it's no surprise that because of these very onerous terms, we're seeing the rise of chain pharmacies that are taking over, much of the country. CVS is locked in with Caremark, a pharmacy benefit manager. They get very favorable terms on those particular prescriptions, and they have enough, negotiating power to, get better terms on the other PBMs. Same with Rite Aid and Walgreens, who are merging and explicitly have said that the reason they're merging is because they want to be able to negotiate better terms with pharmacy benefit managers. And, the independents then get squeezed completely out of this deal, and it makes it very much, very difficult for these particular mom and pop stores, retail stores, to survive.
Okay, but that's not the that's not the worst of it.
Which is not to diminish
that, but so okay, so we have this dynamic where these PBMs basically dictate can really mess with the health of, I guess, these independent pharmacies. Where else does this monopoly that they have, three of them controlling 80%, we don't know, back to that pharmacy store, even if it's Walgreens that is making a better deal with them, we don't know, just because the PBMs charge $100, we don't really know if that's what the PBMs are paying for, right? I mean, their job is theoretically should just be to administer, but they could be marking up or hiding a rebate.
Here's the issue. Yes. PBMs negotiate with the drug companies, and they say to the drug companies, all right, you have a drug that you want to sell for $100. Tell you what, the $100 list price, you're going to give us a rebate of $30 off that. And the drug company, because they want to stay on what is known as the formulary, which is the list of reimbursable drugs from that PBM, which is a very crucial point of leverage in the system. The drug company says, fine, yeah, take $30 and out of that $100. Well, the PBM is under no obligation to pass that savings on to the health plan and subsequently the customer. They can change the name of what that rebate is. They can call it a pharmacy performance metric or some made-up name, and hide the rebate and keep it for themselves. And they do this routinely. And they also benefit on a thing called spread pricing, which is they have a list of, we're going to pay this much money for this drug, right? And they give one set of books, essentially, to the pharmacy and another set of books to the health plan. And they could tell the health plan, oh, we reimburse that pharmacy $50. And then they can tell the pharmacy, we're reimbursing you $30, and keep the spread. And they do this over and over and over again because there is no transparency around what the PBM is actually making on every sale of a prescription drug. And so this raises costs throughout the system. It also creates a dynamic where the actual list price of a prescription drug has an incentive to be higher. And the reason is that the PBM
is getting a rebate.
They're getting a rebate, and you can get more rebates and higher rebates if that cost is higher.
If there's a higher markup, right? You can go back in and you can just inflate the retail price and you call it a rebate so that it's not a lower price. It's just it's a kickback.
Right. It's just simple math that you can get a higher rebate off a $200 drug than you can off a $100 drug. This creates this dynamic. Now, those list prices are important. Even if you think, oh, but they're getting rebates back and they're passing them on. Even if they were passing them on, that list price is how the copay and deductible for a customer is derived. It's based on the list price. It's a percentage of the list price. Or excessive amounts of drugs kicks you into the donut hole where you have to pay for the entire drug yourself. That list price is very, very important, even if it doesn't reflect the actual cost that a health plan pays. So this creates this dynamic where prices are always increasing because the PBM wants it that way and the drug company wants it that way. And that creates more costs, both for the health plan, which eventually shows up in your premium prices, and for the customer itself.
Okay, so I got a couple questions here. What does the contract between the insurance company and the PBM look like that the insurance company can get so played by all this?
Right. So we don't have a ton of transparency on what that contract looks like. In fact, this bill, AB 315 in the California legislature that I'm testifying on, would force pharmacy benefit managers to become fiduciaries of the health plan that they're working for. In other words, they would have to act in the best interest of the health plan. Right now, they're not obligated to do that in most states and in most relationships between the health plan and the PBM. That's much like the fiduciary rule on investment advisors that the Trump administration is trying to deep six. So right now, the status quo is health plans don't have a lot of control, and there's a very good reason for that. Number one, they have very little choice. 80% of the market is three PBMs. And furthermore, they kind of divvy up the country. So even if you thought you had three choices, you really have one in most regions of the country. So what are they going
to
do?
And you can't go to the insurance company. You can't go to the drug manufacturers outside of the system, because the PBMs can say to the drug manufacturers, look, if you deal without including us in, we take you off of our formulary. And so when someone comes in and looks for a painkiller, acetaminophen is just not going to be on there. That's going to be covered. We're just going to cover ibuprofen or whatever it is.
Right. They have leverage over the system, certainly in multiple points. And the truth is that these companies, whether it's a large company that self-insures and does their health plan in-house, or a large insurer, they're just not interested in getting involved in the nitty-gritty of prescription drugs. They see the PBMs as providing the service of convenience, not, you know, they don't have to get involved with every single drug manufacturer and figure out the formularies and do all of those things that is very specialized. And PBMs have successfully argued that they provide value in this system. And so there's little choice. You can't shop around, and you kind of have to use one, or at least you bought into the argument that you have to use one. And so this is the result that you get.
So, all right, how does this work with Medicaid? Do the PBMs provide drugs for Medicaid patients? How does it interact in that way?
Yes, and Medicare Part D as well. Medicare Part D uses a PBM. You know, you hear about this, oh, we're not doing any competitive bidding in Medicare. Medicare uses a PBM to negotiate pricing with the health plan, with the drug manufacturers. And the same is with, you know, employee plans through a union or employee, you know, there it's a number of different. That's why I say sort of health plans is sort of the overriding term, but that can refer to an insurer, that can refer to a government agency, that can refer to a union health plan, that can refer to a large company. All of them go through the PBM as part of the pharmaceutical supply chain, and the PBM is making lots and lots of money off it. The top three PBMs, as I mentioned, Express Scripts, CVS Caremark, and Optum, are all in the top 22 of the Fortune 500 companies. These are massive, massive companies who have tremendous profits. By one standard, Express Scripts has raised their average adjusted profit per prescription 500% since 2003. So their margins keep going up and up and up and up and up. And that's owing to this lack of competition, lack of transparency, conflicts of interest, what have you.
So, I mean, do we have a sense of, I mean, if PBMs had a fiduciary duty, right, which is we're just going to take a specific percentage? I mean,
Right. They could do something that, you know, there are so-called transparent PBMs. They don't have much of the market, but they say, we're going to take a flat administrative fee, and we're going to every rebate that we get with a drug company, we're going to pass along to you. We're going to be completely transparent about it. You're going to see all the cost information. You're going to see everything. And this is actually what California wants to do. Included in this bill, not only is to make them a fiduciary, but to mandate the disclosure of cost information and all of the rebate information, everything on an annual basis, and to regulate PBMs through the, I believe, the Board of Pharmacy or the Department of Managed Health Care. They haven't decided.
Do we have a sense of if that was the case, let's say in California, but nationwide, if it were the case that PBMs operated under, I mean, it's an interesting, you draw this parallel, you know, the fiduciary duty with like a investment bankers on some level, because there's a real quality here to like, the, you know, the selling the crappy securities. You know, on one hand, you're supposed to be my client, but really you're also grist for my mill here. Does someone have an analysis of how much money people anticipate would be saved, or at least I guess would go to, presumably it would go to the consumer, right? Because the insurance...
Eventually it would flow down to the consumer. I mean, because of the lack of transparency in this system, it's hard to make that projection. But I think we know that this middleman would not take, you know, profits that have increased 500% since 2003 if they were asked to be fully transparent. And then a system presumably would emerge where there would be some competition to being gouged. If you knew you were being gouged, you would look for some alternative. I think you can say pretty clearly that would be the case. And you know, I mean, PBMs aren't just doing this. You know, the system isn't just legal and that's that. There are a number of lawsuits and enforcement actions that have been taken against this industry for deceptive practices, for illegal kickbacks, where the drug company says, yeah, get me on the formulary and here's your money. And that included a situation with OxyContin, where the health plan in West Virginia, which was operated by the state, said, we don't want you to continue to have OxyContin on the formulary, and Purdue Pharmaceuticals, through a kickback, paid the PBMs, and the PBMs said, we're going to keep it on there. And this is, you know, largely responsible for the opioid crisis. So it's not just that they're ripping people off. They're creating these situations where perhaps unnecessary treatments, perhaps excessive over-prescribing, all of these things where PBMs, if they were upright, could be a check on the system, they are shirking their duties. And so you have, you know, I think that this kind of market is screaming out for some transparency, and we'll see what California is able to do. There are about 20 states that have some form of transparency in their arrangements with PBMs. One of the problems is, the PBM might be in one state, the health plan might be in another, and the consumer ultimately might be in another. So they kind of work the system to find a venue where they can say they're not eligible for that transparency. That's why ultimately it's got to be done at a federal level. But, you know, California's a big enough state where it might be able to help.
Is there a state in the country where the transparency is actually effective? Like, it's too hard for them? I mean, I imagine California and New York would be two states, in Florida, let's say, would be two states where you would it would be tricky to, you know, really evade this stuff. But
it's hard because you can say, let's go for an example. You can say that, okay, you, the PBM, has to publish your what is known as a MAC list, the maximum allowable cost list. This is the list of how much they pay in reimbursements to a pharmacy, right? Well, the PBM can then just not call it a maximum allowable cost list and then try to say that, oh, we're not publishing that, so we don't have to disclose it. So, and that has happened. So it's just very difficult. It's kind of, you know, it's this endless race between regulators and the companies that they regulate. If it was a national solution and the language was tightened up, I think you'd get a better outcome.
So you'll be providing that testimony on Tuesday, the 18th, actually, while on the day that we release this conversation.
Yeah.
How long has that been bouncing around the California legislature? Or was this something that was inspired by your piece?
I don't think it was inspired by my piece. I know it wasn't. There's a member, assembly member Jim Wood, who's up in the Sonoma County area, who has been looking at this. He's actually a dentist, and he's been looking at this for the last 6 months to a year. And I think in my article, hopefully provided some sort of you know, reinforcement of the issues that he was looking at. And his chief of staff called me up, asked me to testify, and you know, I'm happy to do so. It's an honor.
So, I mean, do we have any sense though of what the potential savings are here? I mean, is it hundreds of billions of dollars? I imagine.
I mean, you're talking about an industry that obtains over $250 billion in revenue a year. So even if it's a small amount on their bottom line, you're talking about billions of dollars that ultimately will go back into the pockets of consumers, hopefully. I mean, either
this
directly.
This is the PBMs make, as an industry, make over $250 billion a year.
That's in revenue. I mean, that's not profit.
Right.
But yes.
That's
gross revenue.
Just seems stunning to me. I mean, because they're a middleman. They're really
a very medicated society, Sam.
But they're also a middleman in between another middleman, right? I mean, this is like a middleman of a second order.
Right. I mean, another way of saying PBMs generate $250 billion in revenue a year is to say that the drug industry generates $250 billion in revenue.
Okay,
in other
so
words,
it all passes
the money's
through
all
them.
Going
okay.
through them. It
okay.
all passes through them. But yes, but they're a tremendous driver of these costs that are in the system, which we know have gone up in aggregate a tremendous amount. It's one of the largest, fastest growing parts of our healthcare system is the cost of prescription drugs. And they're at the heart of it.
All right. Amazing piece. People can check that out at American Prospect. In the meantime, let's move over to the piece that you wrote for, I think it's for The Nation on President Bannon is dead. Long live President Cohn. President Bannon, we know that he ran in to afoul of the globalists and liberals in the Trump White House.
Right.
Tell us about Gary Cohn and give us a little bit of the palace intrigue, but also a broader sense of where this guy is on the sort of the policy spectrum.
Sure. So Gary Cohn is the head of the National Economic Council. He was the president of Goldman Sachs for a long time. He was a lifetime Goldman Sachs executive. And he comes into the National Economic Council, which is one of the few places within the Trump administration where he can just go ahead and hire people with expertise. He doesn't have to wait because those aren't confirmable positions. Unlike the Treasury Secretary or any other part of the government, the National Economic Council can just start hiring people. And he has hired lots and lots of people with policy expertise, and he's brought that to bear on the administration. And obviously, whether it's his alliance with Jared Kushner or the fact that he just has more horses, he has had a significant influence on President Trump. Last week, we saw Trump reverse himself on a number of policy positions in the course of just 24 to 48 hours. He reversed himself on about half a dozen major ideas, including the idea of, that China is managing and manipulating their currency. The support for the export.
Yeah, I don't want to blow through. I don't want to blow through that because because the thing with China, and we played this clip on the program yesterday where he sat down with Maria Bartiromo, and he said a couple of things. You know, apparently, with the Chinese chairman. One, he found out that things were much trickier with North Korea than anybody knew, apparently.
Nobody knew that.
Knew that. He also basically made a deal. Now, people have to remember, and I'll just remind people, China. That's, I mean, that was more than anything else I think, in terms of foreign policy, that is, you know, that was his sort of Alamo, right? What do you think about foreign policy? China is taking us to the cleaners,
right?
And
you know, and people say that, oh, you know, he's making changes on economic policy, but you know, the sort of the latent racism, the kind of policies on immigration and policing, they're staying. Well, you know, I would put the China stuff into that racism bucket. I mean, it was certainly this idea of a yellow menace that was coming to take all of our jobs and rip us off and immiserate the lives of hardworking people in the Midwest. I mean, that was at the heart of what he was talking about. And that has been completely reversed.
I mean, totally reversed, totally jettisoned. Yeah, about right. the currency manipulation,
right,
which he was accusing China of.
Yeah. And people are, you know, I mean, if you talk to economists, they'll tell you, oh, well, China hasn't really been manipulating their currency for a while. You talk to Dean Baker, you get a completely different story of that, by the way. But everybody knows what the point is here, right? It's to loosen any kind of enforcement or crackdown on China's mercantilist policies, which really have created a depressed manufacturing environment in the United States. And that is the influence of Gary Cohn, of the, if you want to call him the globalist, to, you know, make things a little bit better for the multinational corporations who do a lot of business in China and don't want their supply chain disrupted.
And it is sort of stunning to me, and we should say, the stuff that's going on in immigration, I mean, we have one of our listeners, an immigration lawyer, and he is, it's stunning, what has happened in that accord. But that aside, it seems to me that this stuff is woefully underreported, A. B, I suspect it's because the Maria Bartiromos, this is a huge comfort zone for, we should say, you know, not just the Republican establishment, but also, I mean, Gary Cohn comes from arguably the Democratic establishment in many respects.
Right. He was a Democrat, registered Democrat, right up until Democrats passed Dodd-Frank, where he changed every one of his donations from Democrats to Republicans.
Okay, well, fair enough. Then good. At least in that respect. There was some sense that he was unhappy with what the Democrats were doing, which I think is, but
probably a good thing. You're right. This is the comfortable, narrow range of, the sort of, neoliberal consensus or whatever you want to call it, of economic policy. Every single thing that Trump has shifted on has moved toward the very comfortable area where multinational corporations can do their business without any interference from the government, where taxes get lower and lower and lower, where financial deregulation continues apace, and where the sort of frameworks of the new globalization continue unfettered. So you have free trade, and you have the supply chains with China allowing to move forward, and the corporate welfare payments, like through the Export-Import Bank, continue to flow. And all of these things are precisely lined up with Gary Cohn's worldview.
What, lastly, give me a sense of, like, where is there policy daylight between the pushing of the TPP, right, which ostensibly was, was sold in a myriad of different ways, but ostensibly it was to prevent the Chinese from setting the rules of the playing field in international trade. That's
right.
At least what we were told. I guess theoretically it would give corporations more power, I guess, in negotiating with China. For whatever reason, how does that juxtapose that with this notion of, like, I'm going to give China everything they want if they somehow magically wave their wine and take care of North Korea for me in some fashion. I don't know how they would do that.
Right. And but that kind of idea that we're willing to subordinate economic trade interests to geopolitical interests, that has been the status quo of this country for 40 years. That has been what every president has done from Carter on up. Here's the anecdote.
In terms of China,
in terms of the developing world in general, the leaders of this country have been willing to concede on interests affecting working people in America in order to promote their particular geopolitical agendas. That has happened over and over and over again. My dad worked in textiles, and in the 1970s, when he saw that the textile industry in America was falling apart, he went to Washington to petition lawmakers about this, and they all told him precisely this. They said, "We are selling out this industry for world peace." That is exactly what they told him. And that's kind of what you see Donald Trump doing. He's saying, look, we want to get a handle on the North Korean situation. China will give you whatever you want. We'll let your people continue to make our goods. We'll continue to buy them. We will not harass you in terms of the massive state support that you give these industries. And we'll let you go. And that's really we're seeing this deja vu, and that has been, people don't like to use the word neoliberal, but that has been the neoliberal consensus for the last 40 years. And so, to answer your question about how that differs from the TPP, don't be surprised if the so-called renegotiation of NAFTA is just a reinsertion of the items they already agreed to in the TPP, because Mexico and Canada were in that. And that becomes what NAFTA renegotiates into is the TPP. And it becomes a follow-on agreement that other countries in the Pacific Rim can sign on to.
But, so let me ask you this. I mean, in terms of that anecdote of your father, I mean, what was the calculation there in terms of world peace, A, and B, I mean, is it really
the calculation? Yeah.
Well, I mean, is it such a bad thing to trade away certain, trade benefits if it really does, if there's a way of demilitarizing North Korea? I have no illusion.
Well, the calculation at that time was we have all these developing countries. They have hundreds of millions of people in them. Their workers have nothing to do. And they have no industry, and we need to set them up with industries where they can, build up their middle class. And textiles is seen as one of those industries, as a sort of low to middle skill industry that we could put abroad and enable this rise that would limit the sort of social unrest that you have in these countries. If you have large numbers of people out of work, that was the consent. That was the argument back then. But it's become abstracted to the point that now you're just, if the country wants to reach certain political geopolitical goals, then they will do the same thing with selling out workers in the United States. Now, whether or not you think that demilitarizing the 38th parallel, I think everyone thinks that's a good idea. But why must that be coupled with a policy that has a direct impact on tens of millions of workers in the United States? It's not, all of a sudden, it has nothing to do with trade in general. It's not like you're going to site factories in North Korea. Now you're just trading favors and selling out workers in the process. And you can see how that would abstract until the lives and well-being of the entire American middle class is a chip just to be bargained. away.
And we should say, that's not the only arrow in one's quiver, theoretically.
Of course not.
And
yes,
it's the quiver, it's the arrow that basically is specifically at the cost of the broad base of American people as opposed to corporate interests, right? I mean, he could also say, like, hey, we're not going to worry about Disney's intellectual property, you know, for the last, you know, for, you know, if it goes back 50 years, you can have it. I mean, we'll open it up.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole host of property rights and, I guess, legacies and entitlements that they're protecting for corporations, but they won't protect for workers.
Right. What you're saying is there are a number of chips on the table, and the only one that gets bargained away is the worker chip, the intellectual property chip, the pharmaceutical patent chip, whatever other chip that affects large multinational corporations. Those chips never get played.
Right.
It's only the worker chip that is seen as something to concede to reach some sort of geopolitical goal.
And that's where we're at. And Donald Trump has joined the party. Well, that was quick turnaround.
It certainly was. But all hail, you know, President Cohen. By the way, I mean, you know, you're talking about a guy who was president of Goldman Sachs when they were accused of ripping off investors and helping cause this catastrophic collapse in our economy. Gary Cohn was part of the coalition at Goldman Sachs that went to Greece to sell them on these risky debt instruments that actually very directly led to their 10-year-long depression with no end in sight. I mean, this is not the guy, in my view, that you want running economic policy out of the White House.
Well, we can only hope that Mike Cernovich has some real good dirt on all the orgies that Gary Cohn has been attending and pill popping and sugar babies or whatever it is that.
Right.
I mean, you know, that what's also interesting to me, there's sort of this like sigh of relief that Bannon's not in charge of anything, but some of the most odious of Bannon's ideas, i.e. Attacking immigrants in this country, still can perfectly function perfectly well, even if Gary Cohn is basically putting American corporations first and not America first, or however they seem to argue that.
Well, you're absolutely right. And there's been this sort of bifurcation where Jeff Sessions is running immigration policy and law enforcement policy, and Gary Cohn sort of has his hand in the economic policy bin. And those can coexist, absolutely. Bannonism can live on without Steve Bannon. But, you know, it's almost that you're getting the worst of all possible worlds.
Yep.
Because you're getting the finance overall kind of policy on economics, and you're getting the very racialized demonization of immigrants and strong, tough on crime kind of law enforcement at the same time. So there's not one, there's no sort of respite here in terms of what we're getting.
You got to wonder if Eric Cantor is not sitting somewhere in Virginia going, hey, what the hell?
Yeah.
This was my whole agenda.
Right. Now, what's interesting is I don't really think, I mean, there may be several schools of thought on this, but, you know, everything that Trump pivoted into in the past week would not be out of place in a Jeb Bush presidency.
Not
right?
at all.
And Jeb Bush, not exactly a popular figure within the Republican Party. So the question is, will the Breitbarts of the world, will the alt-righters of the world, will be that whole element of the conservative movement, which you can say helped lead Donald Trump to victory, at least in the primary, if not in the general election, are they going to turn their back now on this administration?
Give me your prediction about that, because mine would be there is a 0% chance of that happening, and that they, you know, short of like Tim Carney, I don't think there was anybody in the Republican side who really cared about the XM Bank. All of this stuff, as long as the rhetoric still remains, I don't think they care.
Well, it remains to be seen. I think the proof will be how the country contends economically. Because if you believe that ceding the playing field to these large multinational corporations is going to lead to even larger forms of inequality and worse jobs and inability for upward mobility in key states, then I think that is going to have an effect on the approval ratings. And people will say that's just because of the economy. But, you know, you can argue that it's because of who was put in control of
right.
the economy. So I think that that will tell the tale in many respects.
David Dayan, always a pleasure. Good luck in front of the California lawmakers today, tomorrow, whenever people are listening to this. But appreciate
All
your
right.
time.
All right. Thank you.